Friday Afternoon Deploy is recorded a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Okay, so
wait, don't just jump right into the question.
No, I'm not going to.
Okay.
So context for everybody that's listening is Casey just watched the new Star Wars trailer, and I'm not done talking about it. So can we just agree?
Keep going. John, did that come out today?
Yes.
All right. So for the listeners, it came out a week ago. So old news to you fuckers, but to me,
it just came
just
out.
Happened. Yeah.
Like, can we also just agree that John Williams is the best? Like,
so, yes.
The music, listening to that, just here. Mm. Like, not even seeing it was like, yeah, get goosebumps.
So
right?
I was watching it. The rest of the guys here in the studio were listening along, and I didn't watch your faces because I was watching it.
We had already seen it.
Apparently, you could see you could see the look on my face, and you knew actually right where I was. And mm-hmm. you caught me. You're right, because you said like Lando came out, and you had.
I saw it. I was watching.
Yeah, that got me. I was just saying, like, before we hit the record button, that like I almost get like weepy, just a tiny bit, like emotional.
Yeah,
and like even if you know, like everything that happens in the new trilogy hasn't gone the way I, as a fan, wanted it to go, it's not like the perfect set of films by any means.
Yeah.
But like just the nostalgia is just so, it gets so deep. Like I go and see The Force Awakens. Which is the first of the trilogy. Right? Mm-hmm. I get the names mixed up now, but when I sat down and like just that first horn blast, you know, was just like, I was like, man, what's in my eye here?
Right.
Got some popcorn in my eye.
Some of that damn cheddar dust. But it's pretty good. Yeah.
It's crazy because like I think it sounds like we're so emotionally invested in like the characters and the universe, and like this is what they've done to us, right? Like, after you know, watching it for across multiple decades, right?
Yeah.
My entire life.
It's my contemporary mythology, you know, pretty much. Yeah,
it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, like that, and like Lord of the Rings. I'll fucking watch anything Star Wars or Lord of the Rings,
right? Like, agreed. Yeah,
I don't care if it's shitty.
You got to come by. I don't know if you guys do it at Rev Unit, but we celebrate May the 4th in style, and we're going to be marathoning over here on the projector screen.
I'm going to work from here that day.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
We got the new bar tables out there.
So you got here.
Yeah.
I'll definitely be here.
Yeah, we got hot seats.
Yeah, that's coming up, huh?
Yeah,
it's like a month away.
We'll be ready.
Sweet.
We'll
be ready. I'll be here.
We talked about it. What is it? Does it fall over a weekend or something like that?
Oh, I gotta check that. We may. I think so.
It either does, or we had. It, at any rate,
I thought it was like on a.
It is. It's on a
Saturday.
Yeah, May the 4th is on a Saturday, so we might do. We might observe it on Friday,
on the 3rd,
or Monday. We also thought about just maybe doing it the week of May the 4th and spreading it out and doing like all 8 that are released now, right? Mm. All 8.
Yeah,
like over the course of several days with some gaps in between. So I don't know if you can get away with working from here for that long, but. That's going to be the plan.
I mean, like, really, it doesn't really matter.
We'll try and concentrate a bunch of it into one like celebratory day. But
yeah, it was
fun last year.
It was, yeah. One of our neighbor tenants had to come and tell us to turn it down a little bit.
Yeah, we ran her off.
Ross on us.
That was one of the few times she was, she traveled a lot. She was in her office. That's the one next door.
Okay.
So May the 4th, like, she was like, these people are too noisy, and now that's our conference room.
So we don't have to worry about that.
Nice.
We have the whole floor now.
Yeah, it's funny. I guess we got pretty rowdy with the nostalgia. Just a bunch of like, oh yeah.
Do you watch them in order?
Did we try one of the other Rochambeau order or whatever?
I don't think so. I think last year, if I remember right, we just started with like New Hope and. Yeah.
Okay.
We skipped the prequels last year. We just went straight into the original.
Yeah.
I think we just did the original trilogy last year. And we did it in one day. So that's a full day.
Yeah, it is. It definitely is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it might be better like to split it up.
That's what we said.
Yeah, because it got to like Return of the Jedi and we were just kind of like,
I was like, fuck, I still got a bill.
Yeah, right.
Hours today.
I got to do some stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, hey, it's Friday afternoon deploy, and we're back for another Friday. Blake's with us, Blake Johnston.
I'm here.
In the new studio.
Talking about the JavaScripts.
On the
studio. I know everybody here loves JavaScripts.
On the absolutely.
I like how it's plural.
Everyone
too.
In this
like,
room, yeah.
It's like the Facebook. We're going to talk about the JavaScripts.
The JavaScripts. Hanging out on the studio couch. Is it comfortable over here?
Yeah.
It feels more like a studio, right?
It mm-hmm. feels... that I'm more comfortable than you guys sitting in those chairs.
These chairs kind of suck.
Yeah.
Like first order of business, new chairs in the new studio.
I liked the other chairs in that room.
Those were Herman Miller. Those were nice. Yeah.
They felt good.
They made it to our fancy new conference room.
Okay.
They matched
the
aesthetic.
Okay.
But I'd love to get some more of those, but they are... The podcast studio budgets not quite Herman Miller right
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
The idea was to keep the clients comfortable.
That's right.
Yeah.
People need to sit in a cushy chair when they see that first quote. yeah. So new. We recorded an episode mm-hmm. in here.
If we even mentioned it. I don't remember.
I can't remember if we did or not.
Yeah.
So
who did you guys have on the show last week?
It was just us.
We're just
hanging. Yeah. We talked about incident response, follow-up, that shit that we were fighting last week. We fixed it yesterday.
Wow.
Yeah. So we talked a lot about APM.
Oh, yeah.
Performance monitoring.
Yeah, cool.
The tools we were using because we were like going right through this firefighting. And mm-hmm. I'll follow up on that. We talked about a lot of the great benefits of APM.
Mm-hmm.
You know what's a really good one?
Mm.
Is after you fix that shit, just being able to go look at the charts and go,
looks
oh,
nice.
Oh, yeah.
It looks good, right?
Yeah.
So looks real good. Have that anxiety that
I'm going to listen
right
to that. I'm curious about things.
Yeah.
Melt away when you look at the graph is...
Yeah.
Pretty great.
We covered a lot of ground. I don't know that we went like super deep into all the tooling, but I don't know if you know, we've got this new offering here at Lofty that's mm-hmm. a support service. And so we're like really kind of going deep in how we debug, monitor, and like just like the process around.
And you have to have that to prove the value.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like you have to measure to prove the value, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of the value is like shit blew up. Someone woke up and fixed it, right? I think that's we've identified that as the largest concentration of value.
Sure.
But then the proactive part that kind of comes with it,
mm-hmm.
that makes it worth our while, you know, for us as a business, what makes it worth our while to not just have the terrible job of being on call and fixing it.
Right.
And like not having the job of just fixing something without any... leeway or financial flexibility to actually improve it.
Yep.
Like, because if it were just like this code's shitty and it's going to follow every night and you're on call, that it's kind of an untenable situation, right? For us as a business, we can get that to our customers at a really good price, better than they could hire someone in house to do it for. But obviously, like we're in business to you know like. Improve our services and generate more and more margin and make money, right? This is what we do. So being able to improve it so that like we spend less time firing fires is ultimately for everyone's benefit. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you get more value out of
totally.
One person if you can not have one person
have that
doing
person.
All the things
exactly.
all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So that's where we find margin, right? Is in spending less human time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? I love seeing APM like conference talks. They're like one of my favorites. Those and performance talks are like my two favorite types, simply because it typically is so quantitative. It's like,
totally.
Look at this graph. Now watch me change this graph.
Right.
It's like, I'm in.
Yeah. You're not going to argue with geometry, are you?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting and rewarding to like get into move it and like we you know the particular issue that we were on was pretty gnarly.
It was a performance issue too, so it was very difficult. Like without APM, you're just shooting in a dark room.
Yeah, right.
It wasn't like, and we might have gone this deep into detail last episode, so I won't beat it too much. But there's a lot of different types of performance problems, and this particular one is one of the hardest ones. We were IO bound, which is the hardest to identify.
Yep.
Like, why the fuck is this app crashing and not able? Why is it taking, you know, 5 seconds to deliver a response on like a high traffic API endpoint? when like I'm completely idle on CPU, almost like 0.2%, mm-hmm. you know, and I've got 75% memory overhead, like yeah, free right. analog, like what, why would it go? And the answer was, ultimately it was, database connections
mm-hmm. okay.
being opened. And so the database itself was also idle. The database simply right. was not able to respond to the connection opening request fast enough. So it wasn't busy doing shit except for managing opening connections.
So
nothing about just looking at like your typical CPU right. charts told you jack shit about what was, you looked at that.
It's like, everything's great. Fine.
Yeah. Exactly. It's a dream server. The database is like so idle right now because it couldn't fucking run a query. You know? So APM tools, like
interesting,
super, super valuable. Just being able to see like at a, you know, kind of system call by system call. It's not mm-hmm. quite that low level, but like, you know, individual function calls within the code. And then ultimately for us, like you could see, you know, the Postgres drivers for mm-hmm. Django, mm-hmm. like where the time was being spent
right.
opening a connection. It wasn't even our code, you know, and that's what led us to what we found. The other thing that, and this is pretty common with performance problems, at least I've seen a lot, almost always some convergence of issues.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's like several things have conspired.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And maybe any one of them independently wouldn't cause a problem. And one eventually is the straw that broke the camel's back.
Because that thing was running for like 2 years.
2 years.
Right. Yeah.
Without any sort of, we never, I think all the servers had 2 years of uptime, like without even a reboot.
Yeah. You know,
so aside from, never thought about it.
Right.
Aside from redeployment, like the systems themselves never rebooted. Yeah. But
and it starts falling over one weekend, and
and of course it's on the weekend.
Yeah. While we were building those tables, we're in Alan's garage when it started happening, and so no context for the people on the show, but you saw the tables.
I got it. Yeah, okay. I almost put my drink on it.
So. It's not ready for
one more coat. One more coat. But convergence of issues. Maybe any one of them would have been fine. The problem is that when you start diagnosing it, you find all of them because mm-hmm. you're looking for anything that looks suspect, and you don't know which one to fix. And so it kind of feels like, how did we go from zero problems
to all
I have
problems.
Eight problems mm-hmm. and I have to fix all eight of them in order for this thing to start functioning, which is what happened. We kept finding a problem, fixing that problem.
It's going, like an onion. You're slowly just peeling back one layer at a time.
The last thing that we found was the thing that finally like brought it back, because we would fix a problem and it would improve, but we'd still have allergies.
Finally
got down to, you know what, ultimately, like the thing that actually brought it back online after we fixed all the performance problems? Was it was just getting hammered by a PHP exploit scanner. When it was all said and done and we optimized all the endpoints where it would actually not fall over, all of a sudden then we could see this just huge volume of requests that were all 404s.
Oh.
Yeah. And I mean, it was like thousands per second.
Yeah,
of course it was. Just smashing that stuff. So we reconfigured Nginx to just drop anything with PHP in the request and like humming along super smooth. The benefit is like every API endpoint now responds like sub 50 milliseconds because we optimized every other piece of the application. Yeah. So, you know, like we finally got it there.
In 2 years. We'll talk about this again.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
I don't think we can get it much better from a performance standpoint. If we don't improve the code at that point, we'll just scale it horizontally because it's still running on pretty small amounts of hardware.
It is. Yeah, we made massive improvements. We were like the database queries went from 150, we'll call it, to 7
on a particular endpoint.
Nice.
We had an N+1 query problem. It was all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
That's not the worst I've seen, Alan.
Mm.
That's not even close on an endpoint. On an N+1 query problem, we had one at the newspaper that was just defeated with, this was before Django supported SQL joins. I shit you not. Just couldn't do joins. And I guess you could do, joins on a foreign key. But it wouldn't do joins through a join table. Mm-hmm. So like a multi-table. So you couldn't do like prefetch related.
Right.
So anything many to many, it just like you run a loop and it would query every time you access it. It was lazy querying. It was something like 12,000 database queries to render like a section front in the CMS.
Gotcha.
Like the sports section front or something like that.
That's crazy.
And it was just like, ah, just let that run for 6 minutes and stuff that bitch in cash for, like, for 4 hours and we're good to go, you know?
The poor person who got the 6 minutes is is fucked.
Ah, fuck that guy.
Yeah.
He probably lives in Gentry. He came
back.
That was the philosophy back
then.
Yeah. I asked... Someone's
taking one for the team. Like,
totally. At least it was one person, right?
Yeah,
if everyone had it going slow, like, the phones would be ringing off the hook, but one person, like, you know, for the most part, could probably, like, even if they were, like, sitting next to someone else, like, is it going slow for you? Like, no.
No, it's good, man.
Shit, it's just me. My computer sucks.
Refresh. Oh, it is fast.
I'm going to go to Best Buy and get a new computer. But I asked Jacob Kaplan-Moss, who's one of the co-creators of Django. We did, when I was working there at the newspaper, we did some training. He was consulting with a firm called RevSys, and they did Django training because it was a brand new framework, and it was really only being used in the newspaper industry at that point.
Okay.
And so we went to Lawrence, Kansas, and no, that's not true. We went to Kansas City and did some training. And I asked him about that, like, Django as a framework, and, like, I didn't really articulate, like, it doesn't do joins because I was pretty new engineer at that point. But basically being like, it's really weird to me that it's so dependent on caching. Like, isn't that bad design, you know, that without caching, your site can't load or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember his response to it, but it was, at the time, it was very much the mentality was like, well, why would you generate a page every time anyway? Like, why wouldn't you cache? Mm-hmm. Isn't it, you know, memory's cheap. At that time, the philosophy was like, take Memcache. And, like, just deploy it on every server you've got.
Yeah.
Even if you've got 3 megabytes of RAM available, whatever, just throw a Memcache node. It would cluster and just, it did a pretty good job at it. This is pre-Redis.
Memcache is still pretty legit.
It is good.
Yeah.
It's super good. The thing about Redis is, like, it's great as a cache and it does other things. So once you have a cluster running, why not use it for your cache?
Because
it's already there for some other reason. But anyway, he had a good point. Which was like, you shouldn't be like, especially a content page, like, like newspaper, like, you shouldn't be generating a page every time anyway. So if it takes, you know, like, that was an absolute edge case of this terrible stuff that we were running. But, like, yeah, if it takes, you know, 8 seconds to generate a page, it should be going to cache anyway.
Yeah.
Not a bad philosophy for content pages, I suppose. But obviously Django as a framework matured and do all that shit now. And that's what we were doing, is a whole bunch of, like, using the ORM to manage joints and stuff. But it's come a long way.
Yep. Yeah.
So you had a topic.
Yeah.
I haven't asked you what it is. We're just going to get surprised.
And, okay. Yeah. I actually have two things.
Let's hear it.
So the first one is I have a buddy. Who,
I don't believe it.
Yeah, right?
Does he know you write JavaScript? Oh, it's cold. And I'm sorry. That was brutal.
Oh, fire. Savage. So he is wanting to sort of get into backend development with Python.
Okay.
Kind of work up to being able to get a job. He's in the armed forces.
Got it.
And he will retire from the armed forces in a couple years. Has a lot of, like, database experience. But, like, so what kinds of things does someone like that need to know, to come in even as a junior developer?
To do backend web dev?
Or with Python.
With Python.
Mm. Yeah. Like, what's a list of things? Also, shout out to David. Because he will listen to this.
I was going
to
ask if he was a subscriber.
Yes, he will listen.
Step one, subscribe to this.
Oh, yeah.
Show.
He'll listen to this.
Yeah.
That was shameful. I can think of a few things. What we did here is probably not the best example of whatever every other company does for junior developers, just because we're super small when we started, and we didn't have the resources of other companies, and we couldn't actually hire people that were absolutely really junior. Like, we just had to find people that had at least some hobbyist experience. We still even look for that on the intro level side.
Yeah.
And so,
we had checkbox number one.
Yeah.
Some hobbyist experience.
Some hobbyist experience.
Yes.
With and can you dive into what that means?
Python, obviously, right?
Yeah.
But with, like, web technology. We had a project. I'm assume it's still out there on GitHub. We don't use it anymore. It was called The Project, and it was your application to work at Lofty
Consumed
Labs.
My life for at least a year.
Alan did it. I mean, it was a big deal, right? For someone going from zero to getting that project done. Mm-hmm.
Is it like a prompt, like create this thing?
It's a prompt, yeah.
Okay.
And the prompt tells you to use a couple of different technologies. Okay. So it has you learn a lot of stuff. That's probably more than most places would require out of a junior. Mm-hmm. But just out of like, what do I have at my fingertips right now that's actually a good thing to look at,
okay,
that we had written a while back. It's out of date. I don't know that you can actually complete the project anymore
because Twitter's locked down their API.
Right, you gotta pay for it.
Yeah, yeah. So it you know, sub out the part where go get this data from Twitter.
And
you could get it from elsewhere. Yeah, yeah. It was
Reddit,
just
GitHub.
It was just like content data. It was just search for hashtags.
Okay.
And but what we had people do is they had to build a Python backend application that served up an API to a not necessarily a single page application on the front end, but something that was consumed, like the API was consumed by JavaScript.
Yeah.
We didn't care if you used Angular, React, Ember.
Some kind of Ajax,
so you guys actually require like, hey, you need
it was full stack.
You need to know some JavaScript.
It was full stack. Okay. Yeah,
absolutely.
Now, can you do, I'm the Python idiot, right? Like I know nothing. You could do like server-side like templating, right?
Totally.
Okay. Yep.
And that was one of the options, was have Django serve up a server-side template, but in that template, include JavaScript, then consumes Django's API.
Okay. Right?
So you can have Django serve up the markup.
Okay.
And even like, there's a lot of flexibility you can get there for simplicity, that you can put a lot of like session state and leave that all in the back end and dump it into JavaScript variables in the footer of a page and like a JSON object. So it cuts down on a huge amount of overhead. You don't have to mess with like front end routing or front end session state management, anything like that. You
can
let that all be back end. So that was the thing. And then the thing that I think made ours kind of extra difficult was we had people set up asynchronous processing with a worker queue. So like to complete
like
that project using Celery and RabbitMQ or Redis to be a broker for it. So to get that project up and running, you had to like write code in two different languages.
Yep.
You had to be able to manage the process of actually starting and running like, you know, not necessarily a half dozen, but like three or four different services on your machine, a database, a Redis at minimum, some worker servers and your Django server. So at least four different processes.
And almost then, like, I think you
and
start
they're all
to get
communicating,
it to, like, yeah, I think
you know?
Then, like, you're like, oh shit, now I gotta learn Docker.
Yeah. But we didn't. Well,
certainly
would have been
Redis
a lot easier.
Going, like, that's like the path of least resistance.
This was
point.
Before.
This was, Docker was still black magic
it was
to
still,
the whole world.
Yeah, yeah, it was still pretty experimental.
It
when
had
we started
just
this.
Come out.
Yeah.
I think.
Okay.
So that's
a lot of shit.
That's
man.
What we did, right? And again, it totally wasn't actually entry level.
Yeah.
like if you can do that, you're ready. You're good to go. You might be able to come in like mid-level somewhere.
Okay.
Unless there's just like some you must be this high to ride, show me on your resume, right? But so it's a subset of that for sure. It's less than that, but I mean, I think that's a great working place to start working through.
No, that's
you know?
Good. Yeah.
You get 20% of the way through that and you're probably pretty ready to do some junior stuff.
Cause I know the hard part for me was like, you know, what should I learn? Which it sounds like is kind of, you know, what this question is essentially.
Yeah.
And so that was
what
an
are
example
the things?
Of
yeah.
exactly what do I need to, you know, to make a modern day application basically, you know, and, so that was a really good way to learn that. And so I just kind of studied the different pieces for a year until I could stand it up. And then I tore it down and did it again. You know, after I got it up once to go through the whole thing again. Because like one time's just kind of a fluke. You don't really know what
you
did.
Yeah, that's right. Like what have I done? What have I done? This has taken me so long.
I don't even. Could I do it again? I don't know. Let's find out.
I kicked it enough times and that time it worked and I don't really know what I did.
Right? Yeah, right.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's something that I can put in the show notes in case anyone else is interested.
That would be
to see.
Super cool.
It has to be out of date. I don't think that we updated the prompt for that project since like 2016. Maybe
we can come up with a new one of these days.
I would like to come up with a better one that is scoped a little more narrow. Yeah. We no longer have the challenges we did then. We can afford to train on the job now in a way that we couldn't then. Like back then we needed people to be, if you came to work here, I needed you billable.
Yeah. Right.
Like, you know, within 45 minutes of opening your laptop.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Cause that laptop costs money.
Yeah, right.
And like, and so, you know, that was that it's a different world for us as a company. I mean, it'd be nice to revisit that and really trim that down to something a little more narrow. But
so,
I mean, truthfully, learn a framework. Doesn't have to be Django.
Yeah.
But Django's a good idea.
What are the alternative? Flask. Okay. Which one's more popular?
Django. By a substantial margin.
Okay.
Django comes with, you know, batteries included.
Oh, okay.
Flask is, it'll do all the things too, but you have to go track them down because they're all like third party.
So Flask is React.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And Django is Angular.
Yes, yeah. Kind of, yeah.
Okay.
Well, Angular, Ember, but it's like batteries included.
The analogy I've always used, and this may not be as meaningful for you, Blake, because I don't know if you did Ruby work ever, but Django is Rails.
Okay.
I know
Rails.
And Flask is Sinatra
or
something like that.
I really like Sinatra.
So a lot of people like Flask. They call it a micro framework.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, you can write a one page app in Flask.
Yeah.
A one file app in Flask.
Sinatra is Express, basically, and I love Express.
Yeah.
So much.
Flask is maybe a little bit more like Express because Express relies heavily on middleware.
Yeah.
Right?
Flask is like that paradigm is really nice.
You write a function that returns a raw response, essentially, either HTML or JSON data, right? Okay. You write a function that returns it, and you decorate that function with a route.
Okay.
And that's it, right?
Okay.
You get more complicated as you want to do like parameterization of URLs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But in a nutshell, that's
okay.
That's Flask. Whereas Django, like you start out and you're gonna you've got like a like Rails has
like an asset pipeline and all that shit.
No, you don't really have that as much. In it has some static file management, but no, there's a boilerplate that you build out like scaffolding.
Oh, okay.
So you're going to start with like, you know, probably a dozen files.
Yeah. Okay.
And they have to learn how to organize it and where shit goes.
Got it.
You know, to create that first hello world. You write your own, Django doesn't call it a controller, but controller and template and a model and interact with a database. And you've manipulated probably 7 or 8 different files. So the learning curve is a little steeper, but definitely like the amount you can do out of the box is just massively higher.
Django. Cool.
So learn one of those.
Yep.
And
say it.
A little bit of JavaScript.
Ah,
yeah, of course.
Yeah,
we've said this a million times.
I love JavaScript in my browser. Where it belongs.
That's where it's supposed to be.
Dude, you're breaking my heart, bro.
That's where it started.
We write JavaScript every day over here, but it is browser. It is client side. Learn some of that.
Words.
I recommend, like, if you really want to, no one should learn jQuery these days.
No, do not. No.
I
will back that up.
I would learn Vue over.
That's what
jQuery
I would say.
These days.
Use Vue like it's jQuery.
Yeah.
Drop it in the head of a template. Don't use it as a spa if you don't want to. Use it like a library almost, and just every page of your app.
Yeah.
Do server side rendering or you know, like markup generation. And every page of your app is its own independent Vue app, you know.
Kind of maybe a controversial opinion, but like, don't learn a framework on JavaScript side.
I love that. I've seen more and more. We just got through a round of interviews over here for people on the entry level side, and we found several people that came in that had gone through like a coding boot camp or something like that, or hobbyist or whatever. Several people, had come in and talked about a project. And we said, what did you use? It had Ajax and stuff like that. Like, what did you use on the front end? And they just wrote it in vanilla JavaScript. And I'm like, that's fucking sweet.
Fetch API. Like, it's so much better now, right?
Someone came in and was like straight up talking about like creating, you know, XML RPC requests or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
XML, I don't even remember what it's called because I never mess with the low level that anymore.
Fetch is included now?
Yeah. It's pretty widely supported, but you still got to do maybe sometimes some Ajax as a polyfill or something.
Gotcha. Right? Okay.
It's pretty cool that I see that happening. But the internet is polluted with you know, 15 years of you know, essentially like plastic bags
oh, yeah.
that haven't decayed mm-hmm. full yeah. of jQuery tutorials. And yeah. like, it's like a landfill yeah. of that shit out there. And yeah. so like, but don't do that.
Don't yeah. do that one. Yeah. It's
tempting. If you go to Stack Overflow to ask yeah. a question about JavaScript,
yeah, it's pretty bad.
All of it's going to be the answer is going to, it's going to be a million questions answered by people and upvoted a million times and the answer accepted by people that can't distinguish between what is JavaScript and what is jQuery.
Yeah.
Mm. And there's a big difference.
Yes, there is.
And so, jQuery is not portable to anything that isn't jQuery and it's dead. So don't use it.
Yeah. And so, the frameworks will change, like learn the fundamentals of JavaScript and you'll always be okay.
Am I being too harsh on jQuery? You're way closer to that world than me.
No, like, okay. It's dead, right? I was almost said something very strong. I don't
let it rip.
That's
what we do here.
Yeah. yeah. Well, and then I thought about it for a second.
That's why we have the lights turned off in here.
So they can't see me say it. I've never really been a giant fan of jQuery or used it widely. I have always used vanilla JavaScript.
Yep. Yep.
Or like I started out, I used a lot of Angular 1, which
yes.
do not shit on Angular 1. It was good.
No, that's why I love Vue.
Because it's similar, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. It smells like Angular 1.
Yeah. I can't say the same thing, but I regret it. I regret how much I learned in jQuery.
Yeah.
And before that, when I got into it, it was before jQuery had become popular.
Okay.
You had MooTools.
Yeah.
And whatever that was derived from. There was something else.
Yeah, it was.
It's where that dollar sign operator came from.
It was a Yahoo thing, right? Like,
yeah.
Or
I can't remember what it was.
I don't remember either.
MooTools you had to install something else. Mm. MooTools was a plugin for this other library.
Okay.
And then jQuery kind of borrowed concepts from both. MooTools was animation and scripting.
Yep.
Mm. And this other thing was like the DOM access layer. Mm-hmm. And jQuery became both of those things.
So, you know, I can't be super harsh on jQuery simply because I feel like that pushed JavaScript in the right direction, led the direction it needed to go.
Totally. No, I mean, like, it was changing the world when it came out.
Similar to the way that I feel that the frameworks now do that. You know, like, a framework will introduce some new concept or even, God forbid, TypeScript will come up with something, and then eventually that gets integrated into the standard library.
Right.
Mm. And so I do think jQuery brought about some nice changes that we reap the rewards of now, right? That we don't have to use jQuery to do anything. Like, you can do almost anything in vanilla JavaScript.
I might be totally full of shit. So, I'm just going to say it before I go Google it to find out. And you can, that's what that complaint bucket podcast at hireloftyl.com. If I'm wrong, come tell me. But I want to say, at the time that jQuery came out, JavaScript in most browsers, you couldn't even do like the
query selector.
Right.
You couldn't. Yeah,
you could select by ID.
Yeah, that's all you did. That's all you had.
And what jQuery was doing was like parsing the whole fucking DOM for you.
Yep.
And now you can do that. Now you can select by any query selector. They sort of, I don't know if jQuery invented the query selector syntax. I don't think they did. Obviously not. It's CSS syntax, right?
Yeah.
But as far as the use of using it to manipulate the DOM after it's rendered, And so in that regard, like, massively advanced.
Yeah.
We use that now, even in just like parsing shit in scraping and scraping and stuff like that. We use document selectors for XML parsing.
I was about to say, it was a few months ago, I wrote a little scraper, and it was such a humbling experience simply because it'd been so long since I had done that without like using a framework.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh shit, yeah, this isn't actually an array. Oh yeah. Like, and so I was talking to someone at work about this today. It's crazy, like, how much you learn and then how much you forget.
Mm. Totally.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like our brains are memcache.
Yeah, right.
And you can only hold so much.
It'll let you keep putting stuff into it. It just starts evicting shit
Like
past its CTL.
Exactly.
Yeah. But So learning vanilla JavaScript, I think it's great. Yeah. I don't think it'd be bad to learn something like Vue or something like it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say go learn like all the crazy shit like Redux, state management, and stuff like that. I think that's just too complicated.
I think that's intimidating, right?
So and that's sort of even part of the reason why I'm saying, like,
I say
just
that
vanilla.
As someone who's been writing code, like, professionally for almost 12 years now, and I'm still intimidated by it, right? So I certainly wouldn't want to, like, throw someone who's new to it.
It ain't that bad. How about you guys just hire me, and I'll teach you guys a workshop.
You want to come, work over here? Does your boss listen to this show?
I mean, like, hire me as a contractor, and I'll teach you guys a course.
Okay.
I'll do that.
Come do some training.
I'll do that.
We might do that.
I will totally do that.
That's something.
I can teach you guys how Webpack works. I can teach you all the things.
Webpack, I've come around on.
Literally the best.
It's pretty awesome.
It's literally the best.
And understanding better what it does, and understanding that it's not magic. But knowing what the magic is, knowing what spells are being cast, helps me fear it less.
Yeah.
It's still, like, just insanely complicated.
Yeah.
And my biggest complaint with it is that it allows complexity. Does that make sense?
Mm. Yeah.
It basically lets you configure the most convoluted fucking build pipeline you can possibly imagine, because it'll orchestrate it for you.
Yep.
And in that regard, you know, it's a weapon that's been unleashed on the world.
Yeah. Sometimes that's what you need. But if you don't, like, there are alternatives that actually use Webpack under the hood, and they just do a lot of the work for you. Like, Parcel is one.
Right.
You just, like, dip, done. Like, and for the most common use cases, like, you don't ever have to touch any of that.
There's been some really good stuff that's come out in the non-JavaScript ecosystems to support the integration of these other frameworks, non-JavaScript frameworks. Mm-hmm. And so we use Django Webpack Loader for Django, which does some cool stuff to bridge the gaps between how Django handles static files.
Like, literally, how cool is that, though?
It's pretty sweet.
That's pretty awesome.
It's made that's also made Webpack less, like, infuriating, because it pretty much ships with an out-of-the-box ready production configuration with Django.
Right.
Which, prior to that, was, like, a really big pain in the ass.
Okay.
Like Django has this huge separation of concerns. And so it makes no assumptions about there being static assets on the local file system at all.
Okay. Yeah.
So getting it to use, like, the output of a build directory fundamentally kind of breaks Django's paradigm.
Okay.
Where Django's like, but what if that shit's in S3?
Okay.
You know, like, I can't assume that I can just reach out to that and grab it and compile stuff together. And so they've come up with some clever ways through, like, configuration variables to make it where that doesn't clash too badly with Django.
Right.
It's still kind of a bastardization of how Django wants to handle static files. Yeah. But, you know.
Well, because you got, like, two kind of almost conflicting paradigms,
Yeah, and you crazy bastards won. And so now we have to do it. You can't build web apps without it now. You can, but if you want to use, there is great tooling out there, but you have to have a build system for your front end now.
Yep.
You can't just go download minified JS files and toss it in your web root. Those days are gone.
Yeah, boy. Yeah.
You're fucked.
For better or worse, right? Like, and in some cases worse. Like,
it's worse.
I'm happy to admit that. Like,
No, but
in some
good
cases
it.
It's better, right?
I mean, it's not necessarily worse, because you can still just grab a CDN
it's done away with is it's done away with. You go pull up a project and it has jQuery 0.9. You're like, what the fuck? It took the browser world, which moved so fucking slow, and then just spun it on its head. Now it moves way too fucking fast, and I suppose that's better. It is. I mean, it's progress.
Yeah.
But it's like, you're making omelets and dropping a lot of eggs, but everyone's fed at the end of the day, I guess, is the way to look at it.
So I think we said learn a Python framework.
Yep.
Learn some JavaScript a little bit, at least.
I would say, and then, check out some design patterns, like, especially object oriented programming, and
I have a lot of feels about that.
I bet you do, because I have feels about that in JavaScript.
Right,
inheritance.
Yeah, because it doesn't work.
No, because it's a prototype language instead.
Yeah.
Well, I hear the train in the background.
Yeah.
I guess we're not totally sound isolated in the new studio. Learn some JavaScript. Design patterns, I think, are good.
Can you? Okay.
So I think you also have to learn some fundamentals of HTTP and its derivative technology.
Some more like general, like, how does the internet even work?
Yeah. You need to learn HTTP and like status codes and how that communication layer works. And nowadays, like, there almost no one's building software that's not interacting with some other software. So you need to understand RESTful APIs, how to speak to an API. You need to understand that some, like, we've mostly gotten rid of SOAP and XML-based APIs, so don't learn that, because, you know.
Learn that when it comes up.
Hate your life for a week, and that's how that works. Yeah. But like,
and appreciate how far we've come. That's pretty much what that'll do, too.
Understanding the HTTP verbs and how that works with a resource-based, like a REST API, right? And you know, REST is kind of like Agile, in which, like, no one really implements it
to the spec, same, right?
I mean, there is like the JSON API spec that like Ruby uses and stuff like that. That's a little more strict, but learning that and then understanding now that there are other ways. There's GraphQL, like where you have one endpoint and you fire questions at it, as opposed to it's not resource based. I've lost my perspective so long ago on what it's like to come in the industry now. Because everything about REST is based on how shit used to work, where websites was just a slash delineated path structure of the fucking files in the folder under your Apache server.
Yep.
Right. And so now you don't have, like, single page applications don't need any sort of URL routing.
Yep.
And then we still did our backends with, like, well, we'll make it resource based. So /cars/1 is if there's a document called one in the cars folder. Right.
Yeah.
And so we did that. And then GraphQL came out and was like, hey, why the fuck are we doing that? Cause like,
let's just query this.
Give me a data access endpoint.
Yeah.
Which is actually totally fine.
Yeah.
But without seeing all that history, I think a lot's lost on
it. And I still feel like REST is, like, just so much more prevalent.
It's everywhere.
I'm a huge, ginormous fan of GraphQL. Like, we actually at Revunit, like, we, like, don't do REST very much anymore.
Yeah.
It's, like, a minority at this point.
We do a lot of REST, but Hayden has been slinging some GraphQL.
Yeah.
On all of his projects, and we're liking it.
It's so good. Yeah, it's good. So, to your point, though, like, a general understanding of, like, that there are other options is maybe as far as you go.
Yeah. Mm. Understanding that, like, don't go so far as to understanding WebSockets necessarily. Just know that they're there.
That they're a thing, right?
And just getting kind of that baseline understanding of software doesn't exist in vacuums anymore. Everything's internet connected. And pretty much if you're solving a meaningful problem these days, you are interacting with some system through some sort of communication layer, and it's probably over HTTP, probably. And I don't have good resources on how to learn that. That's a broad topic. It's something, like I said, it's evolutionary. It's like a layer on top of a layer. And these days, I'm pretty sure someone coming in and looking at HTTP now and why we structure the request the way we do and how all the resource, like the patterns and stuff, is pretty much like a Gen Z not understanding why the fuck, like, the save button, what that icon is.
Yeah.
Or, like, if they saw an actual floppy disk in the real world, they'd be like, why did you get a 3D printout of the save icon?
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. Because it's just, like, it's gone.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it has context for us, but that context just, like, diminishes really quickly.
Yeah.
I think the URL structure of resources in like, a path style folder structure just doesn't make sense to people who just came out of a full stack JavaScript.
Yeah.
Like, boot camp.
Yeah.
What about...
Why?
I had two questions. So, I'll start with the... I'll start with the maybe least the controversial one. We'll go with that one first.
Okay.
Can you use functional programming paradigms in Python?
Somewhat. Absolutely.
Yeah. You absolutely can.
You can use, like, partial application and stuff?
I don't know. See, I don't know if it's...
Are functions first class? Like, can you assign a function to a variable and pass it to another function?
Yes. But in a really fucked up weird way, because in Python, everything's an object, including a function. So functions can have attributes, and, like, you can add methods to a function. You can add functions to a function, right?
Don't do that. But
Theoretically,
you can. Right. There's a standard library in Python that has func tools. A lot of that is just how you work with functions and decorators and stuff, but I'm sure that there are some functional programming paradigms. You have, like, map and reduce, like, primitive functions in Python. It's not, I don't think you'll get out of it trying to do it in Python what you would get out of going to, like, is Kotlin, like, a pure functional programming? What am I thinking of? Haskell?
Haskell is.
Haskell or something like that. I don't know that you would get as much out of it out of Python that way, but you can definitely do it. I don't know enough functional programming to be able to speak authoritatively on how complete the language is as far as like the kind of primitive tools that you need to do.
Too big of a fan of object-oriented programming, I guess, really.
Well, and even just like procedural programming, you know what I mean? Like it doesn't, like functional and object-oriented, you know, there's something in between. You don't have to use object-oriented programming and still not be functional. Like functional, like there's almost no state.
Right. Yeah, almost everything is stateless.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And inputs and outputs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I fundamentally get it. I get it from like an engineering perspective. Yeah. I get it from a testing perspective. Yeah. Like how solid that can be.
Yeah.
I get how that could make, on some levels, like dynamic languages almost as like unprone. What's the word for that? less susceptible to errors like a statically typed language because you have such a discrete control over your inputs and outputs. But I'm with you. I do like object-oriented programming.
Yeah.
I like that design pattern quite a bit, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm the JavaScript guy and I'm the functional programming guy. Cool.
Yeah. I'm not against functional programming. I frankly don't know enough about it to talk shit about it is where I'm at on that. Otherwise I'd come for you.
Yeah.
I'm disarmed.
Maybe some other day. Yeah. Okay.
Let me do some light reading.
Okay. Yeah. I'll see you in 6 months.
Okay. I'm going to go learn Haskell.
Yeah. I'll see you in 2 years. Yeah. Cause that shit's dense. So, okay, so my next question, I was just curious about that, but...
Is this turning into Ask the Python Guys? Because I like it.
We got one for you.
Yeah.
Okay, well, okay, hang on.
Yeah, yeah.
After this.
Absolutely,
So my next question is, what about learning, like, Nginx or Apache? Like,
Nginx.
For a beginner, like...
Nginx. That
requirement.
Nginx. Yeah.
Nginx,
okay. Okay, so learn a web server technology.
Yes, and don't learn Apache.
No. Okay.
Apache used to be, like, a long time ago, that was the standard for Python because Python web frameworks all use this protocol called WSGI, Web Server Gateway Interface. And it's a way of having a web server communicate with a Python application, and it just, when a request comes in, a WSGI server is going to take that HTTP request and it's going to shit out a Python object, an instance that is consistent between Flask and Django.
Okay.
They get this request object that has all these custom, so it's just an interface that's
parses an HTML or HTTP.
Yeah. Ultimately, every Python web framework that supports WSGI, which is pretty much all of them, also on the other way around, what they generate when they generate a response from the framework is a WSGI
That makes total sense.
Response object, right? And so back when that first paradigm came around, the only support was a
Apache
plugin called Mod WSGI.
Yeah. Okay.
But once you know, like the kind of what is now like the, I almost like first class, or you could also think of it as like third wave WSGI servers, which were like purpose built HTTP servers for WSGI, like Ruby has Puma, or Rails has Puma. I don't know if that's beyond Rails. We have UWSGI and Green Unicorn, which is a port of Unicorn for Rails.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I love the names. So
then you use Nginx to reverse proxy to one of those.
Right, okay.
But still, like, we don't touch Apache. Mm. Yeah, that one project, though.
We use Nginx, too.
It gives me anxiety that we have one Apache project out there.
Okay, cool.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking, that's good to know.
Yeah, fucking AWS, Elastic Beanstalk, their direct Python support uses Apache Mod WSGI like it's 2006, and I don't understand it. But
they're like, just Docker, and we're not looking back.
Yeah, exactly.
So I just want to let's reiterate a little bit. So we've got learn a Python framework.
Yep.
Learn some JavaScript.
Yep.
Learn some web server.
Yep.
Learn SQL. how the internet works.
Yep.
Some REST, right? Like to me, that includes REST. Like that interview question of like, when I go to Google and I type something in or what happens, that type of thing.
Yeah,
and there are lots of websites that explain that. But learning that, and then, you mentioned
some sort of data layer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Some sort of data persistence.
Not Mongo? I mean, I'm not going to use this. You've opened the door. Well,
you're asking.
Hold it together, Blake. He's trying so hard.
Yeah.
In the Python ecosystem, no.
Seriously, like no one's using Mongo in Python.
It'd be an obscure library.
Yeah. So seriously, if you want to get into Python, all the frameworks and stuff like that are still SQL based for any sort of persistent storage. And then document storage type things, you might find people using Mongo for that as like a, because there's a special case
for like Dynamo or something.
Not as much. Okay. More like for us, it's like Elasticsearch.
Yep. Okay.
It's pretty common. We use it as a document store often.
Okay.
In lieu of a search engine or both. That's a great thing about it is, like it's a document store that you can also search index with. Definitely SQL in the Python world, and that's going to be the ORM for Flask is a pluggable one, but the most common one's called SQL Alchemy, and then Django has its own ORM. So it's good to understand what it's doing.
Yeah,
learning the ORM is one thing, but kind of understanding what a database is, how shit gets stored in rows and columns, and
I would say maybe taking a step back, like since we talked about REST, just learn ORM in general and kind of that.
What does that even mean, right?
Object relational mapping, right? And kind of getting that. And if you already know SQL, then it's just like fireworks going off in your brain.
Yeah.
Like, wow. Okay.
Fundamentally how database CRUD works for SQL databases.
Yeah, that's good. CRUD. CRUD's a good.
You select data, you insert data, you update data, you delete data. And that's most of what you do with SQL database.
That's almost every app. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. That's everything. Yeah. Right. I tell people that all the time. Most apps that we build or anyone builds is clickable lists and it's forms.
Yeah.
And I want to come in today, I'm going to click the list and I want to get a form and I want to type some shit in.
Yeah.
And then tomorrow I want to come back and I want to read the shit that I typed in yesterday.
Yeah, yep. Exactly.
That is most.
That's like 98% of apps.
All software.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And with a coat of paint on top of that, you know.
98% of the time, every time.
Yeah.
Okay, you said you had a question, Alan.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
Well, hit me. So
I remember what it was.
Yeah. I was reading through Python Weekly.
Not that we prepared to gang up on you when you got here.
Yeah, no, I even have to go back and look at like kind of what the question was. But there's. So I guess a while back, we kind of had an internal discussion about like Supervisor and Systemd, you know, and so these are basically tools that manage services.
Mm-hmm. Process management and service management.
Yeah, so Systemd is kind of now the new Linux de facto, I think, that kicking and screaming.
Except for a few holdouts, right?
Yeah,
it's de facto.
They're like a NITD forever.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. The sane people have decided it's the standard.
Yeah. And so we used to use Supervisor D quite a bit.
Okay.
And now if we were going to plug something right into an actual box, I use quotation marks because there's no such thing hardly anymore.
It's all Docker now. But
yeah. We tend towards Systemd, and the little bit of Node.js that we've done allegedly.
Yeah. You didn't hear that, you know,
off
the record, but on the podcast. Right.
Off the record, DJ Parappa is a Node.js app.
Okay.
He runs on this iMac right here.
And he's deployed with PM2.
Yeah.
So we were just kind of wondering, like, so what do you guys, you know, use for process management?
Man, yeah, that's a good question. And maybe a little bit controversial. We wrote our own.
I said it's just running in a fucking TMUX session. That's what I said.
we actually wrote our own. Cluster. Because the thing about Node is like you want to run one on for almost every processor that you have on the compute, right?
Yeah.
And so PM2 is managing like running an instance of Node on all those computes, and helping you route requests to each of the CPUs, and also restarting when something goes down.
Right, right. The most important part, maybe.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And so for the restart portion, we actually used if you're using the cluster API that comes with Node out of the box, you can tell it to restart, to like refork a process if one of them goes down. Mm. But then you have to watch the master process. That's managing all of the child processes.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, we just used Nodemon, which worked fine. Mm. You can use like we didn't use PM2 for a re- there was a reason, and it was like constraint based.
Okay.
So we wrote our own cluster manager that would basically monitor all the child processes and spin them up and do all that stuff. And you could tell it like how many you wanted to spin up and all that stuff. So we kind of did that ourselves. Now that we mostly do Docker, we run one process per container,
right?
And we use Kubernetes. The like, it's a lot more complicated now. Yeah.
Well, the crazy thing is it's complicated, but what you've done, and then what Kubernetes has done, I guess, more generally, and Docker is the stepping stone in between, but it's exactly how we do it now.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that it's the paradigm has become completely homogenous.
Because the processes and the child processes and things, that's at the whiskey server layer for us otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
In uWhiskey, we can configure how many workers we want.
How many threads each of them have and some other like the type of event system that
we use
and things like that, whether it's like eventlet and other options. But fundamentally, one process per Docker container.
Yeah.
And something else
manages
those containers. The service discovery and the communication layer between them.
You can do that with PM2, but it's not fun.
I wouldn't think it would be.
It's not fun.
We're using PM2 for this just toy thing that we do internally because
that's kind of the de facto.
It's a one-liner command that runs our little node server. And,
That's kind of the de facto, to be frank.
Usually keeps it standing up,
Yeah,
as long as
it's currently unplugged.
I don't know if it uses systemd under the hood or not. But PM2 in JavaScript land is like the big one. Hmm. That's the one you see everywhere.
That's what I mean. It was we did a cursory Google search and said, we thought about it the way we think about problems and was like process manager for JavaScript. I assume you guys do that. And then with PM2, I'm like, okay, we'll do that.
Yeah.
It's got over 1,000 stars on GitHub. Sure, let's try that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I was a little, I wasn't quite sure about it because PM2 did a fine job, and I don't have it configured. I didn't spend much time configuring it. It's not like, I don't have a server class configuration here. But from what I found, there's nothing like immediately apparent about how PM2 itself is actually managed as a process. Like if this machine reboots, I have to go run PM2 again.
Yeah, right.
Mm. So what runs PM2?
Man, yeah. So most of the time, like you deploy and you run a start script, right?
Right.
Right. But like, Blake,
which is all
you JavaScript guys. But like, sometimes the power goes out. You know what happens when the computer comes back online?
You push the button.
Oh God, damn it!
Wow. Yeah.
No. Yeah.
What happens? Realistic example. What happens when you have an autoscale group and you spin up a new machine? Hmm. You have a.
Yeah.
What runs the start script?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm trying to tell you, fuck if I know. It works.
Okay. So I didn't know if maybe if PM2 did something when you installed it, like server class that actually maybe was hooked in the system.
You still have to run the node command to start node.
Right.
No matter what. Like,
yeah.
And
I mean, that's how.
And so like in our other deployments, like we'll use Chef and it'll start. Mm. Like if the machine, if you spin up a new instance,
right.
Chef will start node.
So I can kind of answer that because like on some level, when you install it, I mean, if it's on a Ubuntu machine, I know
it's going to have run levels
and probably automatically builds a dot service file that systemd will spin it back up.
So we end up doing that usually manually. That's part of deployment for us is configuring a systemd script or back in the day,
right? Yeah,
and supervisor
in the D
and supervisor like maybe like.
Good old supervisor written in Python, my friend. I don't know if you know that.
I see a lot of like supervisor plus PM2.
That makes sense to me because that's what I was confused about. I get that PM2 is managing the processes, but like something's got to even run that.
Sure,
And that's where like systemd and supervisor. That was one thing.
I know
that,
systemd runs supervisor. Like it when you install supervisor, it's automatically building a dot service file putting it in the systemd directory. Okay.
Yeah, so on, like I said, on our typical node land stuff, like a Chef script does
something like that.
Yeah.
Got it. Can you configure Chef scripts to like run when the machine boots?
I'm pretty sure.
So,
like,
so same thing. Like, it's probably, I mean, it's the kind, like, of thing that you rarely have to fuck with the actual run levels of what happens when this machine gets a whatever the boot signal.
And, like, I know it's Chef, and I've read some of the Chef, but I've never had to fucking deal with it.
That is
so I'm not intimately aware.
That is a testament to the quality of you guys, the templates that you talked about your project.
Oh.
It's just like, we just write fucking code and shit works, right?
Yeah.
We're talking about it internally. Mm-hmm. Like, we have some templates, like project starter kits, essentially.
Yeah.
That usually is just like, it's evolutionary, and it's like, go to the last project that had a similar like technology. Mm-hmm. Topology, if you will, and start with some of the basics from there. But like, I think we're gonna spend some time more formalizing that, and like have you just like a boilerplate project and a couple of different options. And this will be hard to maintain over time, but a couple of different options for deployment.
Yeah,
here's a Docker file. Here's a Docker Compose file.
Yeah,
here's like everything you would need for a Docker based Elastic Beanstalk setup.
Right,
so, Ansible scripts, you know, all that shit. Mm.
So we're kind of experimenting with this. Thought that basically having a command line tool that does all of that,
right?
And so you say, like, you have a default command, and it's basically going to scaffold out the default.
Yeah.
But if you do like dash dash DB MariaDB or whatever, then it's going to go in and like add the stuff in the Docker Compose and blah blah blah. And we're doing that because we're breaking like all of our shit up into ASTs,
right?
And like manipulate, like, on your JavaScript side, Babel, like, you get some of that out of the box from if you use Babel through Webpack. Like, you get access to that AST, and just like, it's so easy to do, which is crazy. Yeah, we're kind of messing around with that. We don't really have that nailed down yet, but that's definitely something we want to do, because there is variability, right?
Yeah.
You want a lot, most of it to be the same, but like, also there's some shit that changes.
This app doesn't need worker processes. It doesn't need RabbitMQ.
Right, or yeah. Or yeah, right.
No, we have something similar internally that we've built. A couple of different people have worked on. It doesn't, for us though, it's purely on the infrastructure side.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's not on the app side.
Yeah.
So that's the gap that we have to bridge. We don't have app templates, but we've done so much with AWS over the years.
That's a command line tool that builds out Terraform scripts.
Okay.
That's the output of it. So basically you say, I want an app. Yeah. It's called Terraform. Or not Terraform, it's called Genesis.
Yeah.
And
it's a good name.
It's reference to the Genesis device from Star Trek, not this, which is obviously a biblical reference.
Either way,
I don't know why I felt the need to clarify that. Genesis device was the device from Star Trek. Anyway, you basically come in and say, I need an application, and you know, obviously it needs web nodes, it needs a database.
Right.
And I want that database to be Postgres.
Right.
And does it need workers? Does it need a messaging queue? Does it need Redis?
Yeah.
And just conditionally goes through all this stuff, and you can pick what kind of instance types are these. You know, I mean, we're talking T2 mediums here. You know,
yeah.
But see, and then that's the other thing. Wouldn't it be cool if we made that
is
where
the is next this question Azure? Is like,
is this AWS?
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, before you even get
and
started.
And then the next question is this a Django app? Does it have an API? And it just prints like boilerplate for DRF.
Yeah.
And
right.
Are you using Vue? Are you going to use Webpack?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And just, and then we'll just sit back. And we won't write code anymore. We'll just fill out command line scripts. That'll be our job.
I really, really like writing tools like that. Like, that's probably my favorite type of development.
Totally.
Is writing tools for other people to use. Because
other developers appreciate that shit.
That's right.
Like, the clients never do. I was talking about this today.
Yeah.
Like, everyone in client services knows this, but you can, like, invent a new fucking class of AI, right?
Yep.
And, like, no one in the world has done this. You can show it to the client and, like, look at this. Like, we're on the absolute cutting edge, and they go, is that our purple in the logo?
Yeah, right.
It's like, God damn it.
Yeah.
That's like a 40-second change, you know? Like,
you show developers and you get like standing ovations.
Yeah, developers. Like, yeah. And it's just like, it's a CLI.
Yeah.
And they're just like, holy fucking shit, sweet. Because we get it, right?
Yeah.
Obviously,
right.
We get it.
Yeah.
I'm not lamenting anything that we don't all already know. Obviously, your tribe gets you, but it can get frustrating in this client services world.
But
We moved mountains with code and you see a hex color.
Yeah.
And right. you don't even know that it's hex.
Right.
You know?
That's not the same color as my Photoshop file. What is that? I don't even recognize that.
Your brightness is turned down, dickhead.
So I think that the other part of the, I guess the flip side of that is that it's also just super easy to get carried away.
Yeah.
Oh, there's so many options. I want to do them all. I want to write all the things.
And then it never gets built.
That's it.
Yeah.
Or if it does, you have the other problem, which is the you try and solve every problem and you solve none of them particularly well.
Yeah,
too much ground.
So
you have width versus depth, you know.
So like we're wrestling with that a little bit and trying to like keep the scope very small. Like there are only like two or three things you can change and that's it.
I think that's smart, right? Yeah. And part of that comes down to, it's not just like the complexity of the tooling, but like kind of at a broader level, we're big fans of common tooling, but also like common tooling means like homogenous like structures between projects, right?
Yeah.
So if you have a lot of variability between projects, even if you have a tool that helps you manage the creation of all that fucking entropy, the maintenance of that entropy is still challenging, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the pluggability of people, right?
Yeah.
I come off of the project I'm on and I go to this other project and everything's different. And yes, there was a script to generate it, right? But still, like my...
Yeah.
You know,
a little different. Everything's a little different. Every time is a little different.
There's
right?
a lot of value in simplicity.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of it, you know, in as many places we can to find, to like the weird yin and yang is like, how can we use process, but use it sparingly so that it's not an overbearing process and through process achieve simplicity because there's, right?
Yeah, right.
The idea is like, how can we...
That's a chicken and egg shit right there.
It's complicated and most people fuck it up and we probably will too because that's the nature of it, but it's basically... How do I make a checklist that makes this get done the same way every time?
Right.
But then how do I make sure that checklist never has more than three checkboxes on it?
Right.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's a really difficult balance to achieve and we all mess up a little bit, you know?
And again, it's easy to like, it's so easy to over index one way or the other, like either too much or too little. And it's a very fine line.
Yeah. Fundamentally, totally. Like when we talk to clients and we do stuff like, you know, it's easy to mess that up.
Yeah.
Just at a conceptual level and help people like over design software. Mm. And we get excited about building software, but like a lot of times, and I'll do this and like, you know, sales folks out there might say like, no, you know, no wonder why you had to go hire a salesperson. You weren't very good at it yourself. Because I will tell a client straight up, like, just use Excel.
Yeah.
Why are you building an app for this?
Yeah. Right.
Please don't get mad at me when I take your money to build you this thing that's like, you need to manage like, it's two-dimensional data, it's rows and columns, you have like 300 data points that are going to change on a weekly basis, just use a fucking Excel spreadsheet. Like, don't build software for this. And I walk into like a design meeting or a sales meeting, and I take notes on pen and paper, because like, yeah, there's a bunch of cool tech shit that I could do, but like, I just, simple is good in a lot of cases, right? Mm. And if it passes the simple test, and like, it can't be done in Excel, and it can't be done on pen and paper, then by all means, let's build some software and work flow the shit out of it, you know? But like short of that, like, simplicity is good.
Yeah.
If you can hit it right and like know the limits, simplicity is the way to go.
I also hear you saying that Excel is good, which I agree with.
Totally.
Yeah. Excel is
great.
One of the best applications ever.
Is it? Yeah. I mean, it's probably a $40 billion application at this point. Like the amount of R&D that's gone into it.
Maybe
it's
even more.
Yeah. It's insane.
But I mean, like, is it like overused and used in situations when it shouldn't? Sure.
Yeah. It's totally abused.
Yeah. Like, it's a really good tool and people overuse it.
Don't use it as a database.
Right.
You know,
but with Google Sheets, you can, because you can query it with JavaScript.
It's pretty sweet.
Of course you can, right?
Yeah. You can do it Python too. I've used some libraries.
Can you?
Yeah, totally.
Oh,
yeah.
That's awesome.
It's actually just querying over an API, I suppose.
Yeah.
Fundamentally.
Okay.
But yeah. No, I mean, like, you know, you guys work with some of the biggest enterprises in the world.
Yeah.
We've worked with you know, some of the higher end of the Fortune 500 on a couple occasions. And it's a fucking shock.
how
much of the business world runs on Excel.
You know, sometimes the best UIs to interact with a database is just a thing to upload a spreadsheet to.
We do that all the time. Yeah. We build a place that's like, here, you know what? We can build forms and a workflow and an API, or you can click this button and download a spreadsheet, fill in the values and upload the spreadsheet, and like business analysts are like, fuck yeah!
Yeah, I get to keep working in Excel, fuck yeah!
Where do I put my spreadsheet when I'm done? Right here, buddy.
That's not an ignorance thing. I mean, legitimately, like, that fits their workflow better. Now, there's the contrary side of it, which is, I'll say the exact same thing. You would be shocked how much of the business world runs on Excel. And there's shit that's like, this is how many billion dollars a year runs through this fucking spreadsheet on Chad's computer?
Yeah.
You know, where's Chad? I don't know. Yeah. But we're not going to be able to.
Chad got hit by a bus.
Yeah.
So.
We're not going to be able to do the fucking quarterly earnings report if we don't find how to use Chad's spreadsheet. Like, that shit happens too. That's where it gets used for bad, you know. But often, like, the solution there is not to rebuild Excel.
Yeah.
It's just to build an Excel data distribution model that gets Chad's spreadsheet, you know, into fucking OneDrive or whatever. It's simplicity is good. And so that was like a huge tangent around that. But what we were thinking is, we have this thing that kind of what you're talking about, purely for infrastructure. And I'm thinking we build something for the app side, and they're totally decoupled tools that do whatever they do.
Same thing.
You combine the output.
Front and back end, like, is the way that we're approaching it. Like, you have front end tool, back end tool.
Yeah, that's cool too.
Because we're wanting to even be able to, there's a little bit of boilerplate when you're doing like a like GraphQL stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're wanting to be like, hey, create a query on like in a React app. And so there's a little bit of stuff that you, so like, query, name this, go. And it creates three or four files, like, and puts the boilerplate in there. I mean, and it's different for the back end is the reason we're splitting them, and different concerns, different way kind of things are organized. And so we split up in two different tools, and they're right now, like, there's only one of them written, and it's all in its infancy. The templates have been around for a bit, but this tool concept is kind of new and something that, you know, we're still thinking through, but we'll probably end up going that way.
That's pretty sweet.
Mm-hmm.
We love those kind of things too.
Yeah.
And as we grow, we have the luxury of being able to invest more and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it's a developer happiness. And those are the kind of things that we love the idea of also. I mean, it's hard as we're a business. We're capitalistic. It's hard to look at that and, like, you want to open source it, but at the same time, it also becomes a trade secret. It becomes some secret sauce that gives us an advantage out there.
Yeah.
And I don't want you guys over at RevUnit taking our sweet infrastructure provisioning tool.
Your sweet, sweet Pythons.
Yeah. and just padding your margins with it. But you know, there's a lot of things like that we do open source. You know, we've got a few. We're not like the most like amazing. It's not about a lack of contribution to the open source community. We just don't have a lot of projects ourselves that we've conceived, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we have a few. And some of them get some love, and as we grow, we have the ability to do more of it. We like to do that, and so maybe some of these types of tools would be fun to do those sort of things, open source them as well.
So I have a little bit of a tangent.
All right,
and I've been thinking about it.
This is a final tangent.
Yeah, okay. And I've been thinking about this whole time. I know we're running out of time, but I got to get this out there.
Okay, let's hear it.
Because it's relevant, because it just happened.
Mm.
This week, the Stack Overflow developer survey results released.
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I have.
Okay.
Yeah.
Rust and Python are the two most loved languages by developers.
People love Python. I knew that.
Yeah.
People love Rust, and I'm hearing a lot about it.
Right.
Yeah. I love Rust.
You like Rust? That's right.
I love Rust.
Done a little bit of it.
I've been doing a lot of Rust lately. Like, spending time that I would not normally spend writing code, I've been writing Rust.
I've only watched a tutorial in Rust.
Yeah.
And it looked cool. And this was like two or three. This was like, actually, it was more than that. This was like the second or third Fayette Pi Python meetup meeting, which goes to show you how hard up we were for content, that like our second or third thing was a Rust talk.
Wow.
Ryan Heber gave it, and he was gracious enough. He contrived a good example of how to tie it back to Python. Basically by showing how bad it beat the living fuck out of Python.
I remember.
Performance-wise.
I remember. I know he's been into it for a while, too.
I mean, this would have been like in 2016.
Yeah, it's been a while. Yeah, right.
Or maybe even 2015.
I'm a newer
convert, but I really like Rust like a lot. The only other language that I've liked quite as much as Rust, other than JavaScript, of course, has been Go.
Yeah,
and I like and I
fun.
And I like Rust more than Go. So
that's a pretty good testimonial.
Yeah,
I'd say.
Yeah,
because I've never heard anyone say anything bad about Go.
Yeah, so I have two things about Go that I don't like. The package management system.
Oh no, I have people. That's GitHub. Good. That's good.
Yeah, GitHub.
Yeah,
And the second is like there's no generics. Like really?
Okay, that one I haven't heard.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
The package manager, that is a legit complaint that I've actually heard many times. I
forgot about you know it. The GoPath too, like that whole thing.
And, dude, yeah, the environment that shit. Yeah,
it takes a whole day to set up your environment, and then you can hit the ground running.
And I feel like that is just that's a maturity thing. Like almost every language is some path based, like the fucking Java paths. And shit.
Yeah, Java's got a
Python has
Java
its Python path. Ruby has paths and stuff like
Java's
that.
Java's just been around so long, you know, Maven abstracts a lot of that away.
Yeah,
you get
tooling around it. You know, like back in the day when I wrote Java, like when I was doing my undergrad work, it was like the first step of every project was going into your IDE and setting a bunch of fucking path shit in the IDE, which worked fine in the IDE and fuck knows how you actually deployed it because it was college and we didn't actually do anything practical.
Yeah.
But, we didn't do anything practical except learn how to fucking take out debt. But
chug those beers, baby.
But so I think that the path parts maturity thing, the package manager thing, not a maturity thing. Mm. That's a fucking ego thing. And I say that because I have talked to like a dozen different Go developers and brought that up. Like, what's with the lack of a package manager? Which there is one, by the way.
Yeah, I know there's one. Now. I haven't.
It's not widely adopted.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've actually messed around with Go, probably 18 months.
In the early days, I would ask Go developers about that, and they all just like fucking folded their arms and got all smug and was like, we don't need one if you're not a dipshit, you know, or something along the... They didn't say exactly
like,
that.
Like what?
Actually, every Go developer I ever met was super nice, but they would say something along the lines of like, we don't need one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was just like,
okay.
You don't need one until you don't, until you do, you know?
I think we talked about this a little bit before, but coming from JavaScript, like I just have super high expectations for a package manager because NPM or Yarn or whatever the fuck is good. It's so good. So Python has pip, and I know it's also very good.
Same kind of thing, yeah.
It's good. I'm being fair. I want you to know I'm being fair in my brain because I'm thinking to myself, and then in the back of my head, I'm going, is it? But the reality is that I think NPM and Yarn are both good.
Yeah.
My complaints come not from the package managers themselves, but from the shitstorm that they have to manage.
Yeah.
The dependency chains and how big they are.
That's just JavaScript, man.
Yeah. I mean, if every Python dependency had, like, you know, 40,000 like dependencies in its chain, then I would have the same complaints about pip. So, they're good.
So Cargo, which is Rust package manager, is like amazing.
Right.
It's so good.
It's a great name.
Yeah. Like it's Rust is like, man, you should try it out.
I'm going to.
I'm a huge convert. Like I've been like evangelizing the shit out of it at work. Mm. Like let's use Rust for something.
I'm going to try it. I'm going to go look. That sounds like a fun weekend project.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Speaking of which, it's the weekend.
It is.
I'm calling it. This show's over.
All right.
It's time to go.
Let's go learn some Rust.
Do some Rusting.
Yeah. I'm anxious to hear about that.
Thanks for coming back, Blake.
Yeah, man.
You're welcome anytime. You
awesome.
Know that.
I'll be here next week.
Cool. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Friday Afternoon Deploy, recorded and produced by the team at Lofty Labs. If you enjoyed the show, you can subscribe to future episodes via iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. You can also follow @FridayDeploy on Facebook and Twitter for episode previews, live streams, and other behind-the-scenes peeks. Past episodes and show notes on this episode can be found at friday.hirelofty.com. That's friday.hirelofty.com. If you'd like to contact the show, or if you're local to the Northwest Arkansas area and would like to be a guest on the show, you can email us at podcast@hirelofty.com.